Hi, listeners. Anna here. Just want to remind you that I've got another new podcast out called The More You Scroll, a show about trying to stay sane on the internet. You can listen to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, guys, it's Leah. Don't forget to head over to yumday.co where you can shop snacks from your new favorite snack makers. And listeners, we have a special promo for you. You can use code FOODDAYPOD at checkout to get a discount with your first purchase.
Hi, everyone. From Yum Day and Van Valen Productions, this is the season finale of Every Day is a Food Day. I'm your host, Anna Van Valen.
And I'm your other host, Leah Ballantyne. On Every Day is a Food Day, we celebrate food stories from our calendars to our kitchens.
Food stories are people stories, and today's stories are poppin'.
Because in this episode, we're talking about popcorn.
Today we're moving from food trends to food rituals. In the deep dish, I'm going to tell you the century-old love story between popcorn and the movies.
But first, I'm going to tell you about popcorn holidays, like National Popcorn Poppin' Month, how popcorn inspired a favorite breakfast dish, and the surprising story behind that famous Cracker Jack jingle.
For more great content about the foods and stories we talk about on the show, and to get a peek behind the scenes, connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at FoodDayPod, or visit us at yumday.co/podcast.
Be sure to subscribe and help us get the word out about the show by sharing it with anyone who loves food, podcasts, or both. To help other listeners find it, leave a rating and review.
Leah, how much do you love popcorn?
I love it so much. I eat it almost every day.
I do too.
I'm not lying. I really do eat it all the time.
Just microwave popcorn. You get the bags.
Yeah, the microwave popcorn. I used to use the Whirly Pop.
Whirly Pop?
It's the old-timey stovetop popcorn popping pan. You do get the best popcorn that way.
Really?
I'm convinced. But I've gotten lazy, so I've been microwaving. But yeah, I used to Whirly Pop my popcorn.
How does it work? I want one now.
Oh my gosh, you should totally get one. So you've got your, you know, big metal pot, and then you throw your kernels in, you put a little oil in there, and then you can salt it, season it in the pot. And then there's a little crank. So you put this lid on it, and then it has this thing that spins the kernels around.
Like a salad spinner?
There's a little crank. Kind of like a salad spinner, but there's this crank on the end of a handle that goes down, and then it has like these little wings, and it just spins the kernels. So as you're heating it up, you're spinning the kernels, they're getting coated in the oil, and then when it gets hot, it starts popping in there.
That must be so satisfying.
Oh, it's great when you're like, pop, 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 and you start to feel it in the Whirly Pop, and you're just like, ooh, I'm going to crank it harder. So good. And then when you see, like, the cover is kind of split in two, and there's, like, a hinge in the middle. They clip down, but you can tell, like, one will start to poop, poop, like, ooh, pop up a little bit more when it gets to the top.
Does it have, like, the side butter melting component?
No.
We had an air popper when I was a kid, and it was a machine that you plugged in. Mm-hmm. It was very satisfying because you would pour the kernels in, and the air, it was like heated air inside. So it was, there was blowing around. And then as it would pop, it would blow them up, and then they would like come down the chute.
Ooh.
And then you would also, on the back, you'd set this little, you'd put butter in this little container. And then because it was heating up to pop the kernels, it would melt the butter.
That's genius. I love
it. It was all melty, and then you would like drizzle it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I've never had an air popper. I've been thinking about getting one, though, because air pop popcorn, well, I guess if you don't pour the butter all over it.
Yeah.
Should be better for you, right?
You can get the butter spray.
Yeah.
Lou loves butter on his popcorn so much, and so do I. But, like, we get the unbelievable butter. Extra super dripping in butter, and he still sprays the spray bottle.
Really?
it makes me feel fancy no matter what. Like, it turns everything into a little event. Like, even if it's like, I'm just going to watch these old episodes of Bob's Burgers.
But once I'm you like, make popcorn.
But first, I'm going to pop some popcorn.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and but you can make popcorn super fancy if you want to. That's the great thing about it.
Oh, like, yeah, there's all those toppings.
Yeah, toppings and seasonings. And I put like truffle oil on it and I feel what? Super high class. You should totally drizzle truffle oil on your popcorn.
Maybe I will.
It's amazing. And then lately, I've been making my popcorn super spicy with togarashi seasoning. So like the
What's
Japanese
that?
Like chili pepper spice. It's Ooh. Super good. And I just sprinkle it all over.
I'm so basic with all my food. I'm like, yeah, Orville Redenbacher and spray butter. And you're like, I import this Japanese spice, sprinkle it on top, and then I layer in truffle oil. Mm. I was thinking about, I don't do this now because there's a person I live with who watches me eat the popcorn. But when I was alone, this is so gross. I don't know why I'm telling you this. But I was
Tell me. Like,
In order to, I mean, laziness, but also avoid getting popcorn grease on my hands, you know what I used to do?
What did you used to do?
So I'd have the bowl or the bucket, uh-huh. and I put it really close to my face, mm-hmm. and then I would just, like, stick my tongue out like a frog, and then the popcorn sticks to your tongue, and you just pull it back into your mouth?
I've done that before.
Oh, good.
Just out of laziness.
I'm just imagining myself. I'm like a frog. I'm like, blah, blah.
It's usually because I have my hand on the remote and the other hand holding
well, yeah,
the popcorn.
Well, yeah, you don't want to get it greasy.
Yeah, so I'm just like, bleh.
It just sticks so perfectly.
It does.
Okay, good. I'm glad I'm not alone.
There's no wrong way to eat popcorn.
There's no wrong way to eat popcorn. Yeah, and popcorn's also just associated with all kinds of fun things. Fun mm-hmm. things, special things. We're going to talk a little bit later about popcorn in the movies.
I can't watch a movie without popcorn, especially if I'm at home. Like, no, I got to make popcorn.
Right. You know, listeners, Leah and I met working at a movie studio. May it rest in peace.
We did.
The movies is what brought us together.
Yeah. You know, we were just Hollywood people.
We were just those the Hollywood elites. Mm-hmm. Me and Leah.
Yep. So
those
that's so
out
us.
Of touch Hollywood elites. That's us.
Uh-huh. Don't know anything.
Don't know anything about real life.
Common people.
That's right. It was all glitz and mm-hmm. glamour
every day. But the movies did bring us together.
The movies brought us together. We got to watch movies all the time.
We did.
In all kinds of theaters. Mm-hmm. And it was so fun. And it was such a magical place to know that you're in the same place that created some of the most important, most viewed, most loved movies, you know. And I always love that about the movies is that it's this universal language of, you know, mm-hmm. you can go anywhere in the world and be like, dun, 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 dun. Everybody knows what that is, you know. Or you can say, like, click your heels together three times and say,
there's no place like home, and you get it.
You get it, right? Mm-hmm. I just love that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like food.
It is like food. Another universal language.
So it makes sense that movies and food are connected.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like that segue, everybody?
I love that. That was so smooth. Like peanut butter.
Smooth like Crisco laden peanut butter. No, we had serious sounding jobs. We did do some serious things.
We did do serious work. Very serious.
Yes. There were CEO reports.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All the time.
I worked in operations strategy.
That's right.
Until I invented a job that I would have rather done. I do that a lot, listeners. I was like, we should have a podcast division. And then I just harassed everyone for 2 years until they let me start one.
And look at that.
And look at us now. But I did. I made a beautiful podcast called Screen Dive that if you guys haven't listened to, you should listen to. I interview Mel Brooks.
I know.
I made Mel Brooks laugh.
It's amazing. I love that you interviewed Mel Brooks and now you're doing this with me. So obviously Mel Brooks and I are basically in the same category.
You are the Mel Brooks of food podcasts. So Leah, food holidays for popcorn. I mean, I can't imagine a world where we wouldn't want to celebrate popcorn.
Right. I know. I wouldn't want to live in that world.
I wouldn't want to live in that world either.
Get me out of here.
What a terrible dark place. I mean, darker than the one we're living in now.
But yeah, thankfully we do have popcorn holidays to celebrate. So
excellent. And we just had one, right?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we just had Popcorn Day on January 19th. And there are a handful of other popcorn holidays. There is a National Popcorn Lovers Day.
We love those Lovers Days.
We love the Lovers Days. And that one is the second Thursday of March. So it kind of floats around every year. Mm. Keeps us on our toes.
Yep.
There's National Caramel Popcorn Day in April, April 6th. There's National Popcorn Poppin' Month. And it's actually called Popcorn Poppin' Month. No G.
Love it.
And that's the month of October. And then National Popcorn String Day, December 13th. Which makes sense.
Do they last another 12 days? They dry
they
up?
They can. I tried to make a popcorn string, popcorn garland.
Uh-huh.
And pro tip, don't use buttered popcorn because it becomes super messy.
A little
but
slippery.
That's the only popcorn I had. And I was like, Yeah. I just ate it, really, at the end. I was like, I made the string. It looks kind of cute.
I mean, at least it's a craft that's easy to clean up.
That's true. It's a sustainable...
sustainable, reusable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really upcycle that popcorn string into your mouth.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we just had Popcorn Day, January 19th. And Popcorn Day has been observed in some way since 1988. But according to the internet researchers, there's evidence that suggests that the day used to actually be celebrated towards the end of January because of the Super Bowl.
Oh.
Popcorn's a huge snack, so.
Yeah.
And then we have National Popcorn Lovers Day, the one that's on the second Thursday of March. And this day's kind of sweet. So it was created in 2012 by a man named Bob Matthews of Rochester, New York. So up in your neck of the woods.
That's right, near my hometown of Buffalo. Mm-hmm.
And so Bob is kind of like the OG popcorn lover. So he would make popcorn for his wife every Thursday. And it was just like a little sweet snack he would prepare for her. And Bob apparently was an avid gardener. And he used to grow his own popcorn. Dry his kernels and make his own popcorn.
All right. I'm from Western New York. It's not exactly prime corn growing territory. So I'm impressed and confused.
Well, apparently Bob figured this out. And I did a little bit of research and digging on this whole Popcorn Lovers Day and the story of Bob Matthews. And there's, it's like an old website with an old gardening forum. And I think that's where it first popped up.
Oh.
Popped up. but yeah, he was like part of, I guess, a gardening network and had figured out how to grow his own popcorn corn, special variety of corn at his home. And then he would just grow his own, dry his own kernels, and then make his own popcorn, and then make popcorn for his wife.
Adorable.
It made me really curious, though, about trying to grow my own.
Oh, yeah. You could grow some corn right next to your ghost peppers.
Ooh. I wonder if I, like, did some sort of crazy, like, cross-pollination and, like, crossbreed these things and get a very spicy popcorn.
Popcorn husbandry.
Mm-hmm.
That's season two. That's season two.
We really just go deep into, you know, agriculture and
all kinds of experimenting, making up new foods so we can make more holidays. I'm for it.
Ghost popcorn.
Ghost corn. Pepper popcorn. Ghost corn.
Yeah.
You know that would be in every Brooklyn bar. Little bowls of ghost popcorn.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Every cafe in Echo Park. Ghost pepper popcorn.
Guys. All you Echo Park Silver Lake peeps, give me a call. I've got my super small batch, homegrown.
Artisanal.
It is artisanal. I use only heirloom popcorn to make this. And I've been using the same seeds from a ghost pepper plant that I planted years and years ago. So.
Wow.
I can see the branding right now.
Totally.
It's sick.
I love it. It's better than pirate's booty.
But, you know, like, the big popcorn celebration is National Popcorn Poppin' Month in October. It's been around for a while. The Popcorn Board actually started to promote, you know, this month as a celebration of popcorn because that's when the popcorn harvest typically takes place in the Midwest.
Right.
The thing that made Popcorn Poppin' Month official was that it was actually declared in a proclamation by the Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, in 1999.
Wow. That's very official.
It is a very official
proclamation.
Mm-hmm. Once you've got the proclamation out there, you know, you just can't argue.
Right.
But can you imagine, like, the proclamation is for National Popcorn Poppin' Month? They had to have the poppin' in there.
Well, yeah, they don't want you to be passive about it.
Yeah.
So you need to be poppin' it.
You got to be poppin'.
It's a call to action, really.
It really is.
That's smart.
So Popcorn Poppin' Month is in October. It happens to also be the peak period for popcorn sales. They say for home consumption, you know, happens in the fall. And the other thing too, and I think this ties into the events that you're going to talk about, it's like, you know, football, all kinds of sporting events, people eating popcorn, popcorn concessions. So fall is a big time for popcorn.
Well, and also it's getting colder. So people are home inside more. And fall is a great season for movies. I get it. We lean into the popcorn in the fall.
It's popping. It's popping.
Popcorn gets popping. I mean, let's be real. We eat it all around the calendar, all year long. But I can see how sales might peak in the fall.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, too, is that the Popcorn Board was actually formed in 1998. So the year before Popcorn Poppin' Month became official. So I felt like the board got together and they were like, guys, we know how important popcorn is. We're going to have to push for, you know, the government to recognize October as our month.
Well, we know these boards, these food boards, they carry some sway.
But I mean, there's a lot to celebrate about popcorn. It's a snack. It's been around forever, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say, I think it's true that this is probably the world's oldest snack food. So there's tons of evidence that shows that popcorn was cultivated all over the Americas for thousands of years. Old ears of popcorn were found in New Mexico in like 1948, 1950, and they were carbon dated to be around like 5,600 years old.
Wow.
Probably even older by now.
In Native American caves and ruins, right?
Yeah.
And when you say ears of popcorn, that's because not all kinds of corn, strains of corn, are popcorn.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there's a specific corn strain that is the popcorn.
Right,
corn
right.
That makes popcorn.
Yeah. Just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah. I think we all just assume from cartoons that like any old ear of popcorn, once it gets hot enough, will just like pop into popcorn.
Right. But no, there's specific strains because of how much moisture is locked inside of the kernel. And then what happens is that moisture kind of cooks and pops and bursts out of the outer shell of the kernel. So it's not all of them.
That's a very good point. There were archaeologists who found popcorn in Peru that was almost 7,000 years old.
What?
You had Aztecs. They not only ate the popcorn, but popcorn was used ceremonially. So they were used for headdresses, necklaces, and other ornaments. In Chile, archaeologists found popcorn at a burial ground that was over 1,000 years old, but it was so well preserved that they actually believed you could still pop those kernels today.
Did they try it?
I don't know. I kind of wonder if they did. I bet somebody did. You know, one of those archaeologists.
Oh,
did.
Yeah. Those archaeologists, they like to try the stuff that they find, like in the Egyptian tombs.
Yeah, the ones that ate those
groats.
Groats.
You're not supposed to eat the artifacts, guys.
No.
God. But I know we've talked about the Egyptian tombs, and every time they open a new one, there's some new amazing things in there. And then there was that thing about Pompeii.
Yes.
And they found snack foods in Pompeii ruins. So it seems like these Native American caves, they're like the America's equivalent of the Egyptian tombs.
Oh, my gosh. It's so fascinating. Like, I love hearing about all of the things that we find in Egyptian tombs. The Pompeii Thermopylae.
Amazing.
The snack bars. So cool. And yeah, now we've got like old caves, old bat caves, where you can find old popcorn. And they still could pop today. I bet you one of those guys tried it.
Yeah. One of the guys just like, oops, I dropped it. A few kernels came off in my hand.
Yeah. So yeah, popcorn's been around thousands of years. And over time, I mean, popcorn just spread across the Americas. I mean, colonists started adapting the popcorn variety, began eating popcorn as well. And reportedly, colonial women made the first breakfast cereal by putting milk and sugar on popcorn.
Oh, so corn pops.
Yeah.
Makes total sense.
It does. So apparently one person who continued to experiment with popcorn as a breakfast cereal was a woman named Ella Eaton Kellogg. Does that last name sound familiar?
I think I've heard Kellogg's and cereal in the same sentence at some point. I don't remember. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Ella Kellogg was married to John Harvey Kellogg, heir of the Kellogg's empire, was a woman that really enjoyed popcorn. And she figured out how to grind the popcorn with milk or cream to make a delicious snack. Ella was kind of a popcorn evangelist. She used to recommend that people would eat popcorn with their meals because of its nutritional value, how good it tasted. And Ella knew this because she was actually a dietitian. She was a nutritionist.
Oh.
She was born in the mid-1850s, and she graduated with her bachelor's degree from Alfred University in New York at the age of 16.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah. And she also got her master's there. So she's just this genius woman who became a pioneer in dietetics, became a nationally recognized dietitian. And, you know, on top of that, just was someone who wanted to create recipes that were healthy. You know, she tried to create foods that didn't use refined sugar. She was a big promoter of vegetarianism. You know, she just thought that eating well would help human civilization overall.
Was she involved in, I can't remember which Kellogg brother. One of the Kellogg brothers had the sanatorium. That's her husband.
Mm-hmm. So her husband, John Harvey, was the director of the sanatorium. And that's actually how she met him. She'd gone there because she had a family member who was ill, who was there. She ended up meeting him at the sanatorium and then getting a job there and working there and basically running the whole food service department.
Wow. So she was like the resident nutritionist.
Yeah, exactly. So she pretty much ran a lab out of the kitchen there. And it was where she would, you know, do all of these experiments and trying to figure out like what foods were best for the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And how could you use food to heal? At the same time, she was also writing for a magazine called Good Health. She eventually became the editor of that magazine.
Wow.
And during this time, while, you know, basically running the sanatorium with John Harvey Kellogg, she founded a school of home economics, wrote three books on food. One of them was called Science in the Kitchen, which was like a full 600-page illustrated cookbook.
Whoa.
Yeah. She also was the chairman of the World's Fair Food Supplies Committee.
And we know about those World Fairs.
Yep. And yeah, so all the work that she did really like contributed to growing the field of home economics, dietetics, and she was also in favor of like women's suffrage and children's rights.
Cool. And we've never heard her name or her story, just her husband.
Yeah, we always hear about John Harvey Kellogg and his brother William, but we rarely hear about Ella Kellogg. And she's the one who actually created a lot of these recipes that ended up inspiring the different breakfast cereals and health food products that we have today.
Huh.
So, you know, in our peanut butter episode, we mentioned how John Harvey Kellogg is credited for making one of the first commercially available peanut butters, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I read an article from the Paris Review that suggests it was Ella's idea, which makes sense, and that she developed the recipe as a meat substitute. So, I mean, maybe it was a joint effort, but it would have been nice for Ella to get some
credit. Would have been nice.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been nice. And look at us. We didn't even know. We didn't even credit her last time.
I know. And you know what else Ella created? Granola, which was based on a recipe from one of their associates that she ended up refining. And the granola was such a hit with the patients at their sanatorium that one of their patients named C.W. Post used it in his own product, Grape Nuts.
Ella is the mother of American cereal.
She is. And you know, one of her most famous recipes, which involved crisping up the flakes of wheat, became the inspiration for one of our most famous breakfast cereals today, Corn Flakes.
Oh my God, Ella invented Corn Flakes. Wait, crispy flakes of wheat made Corn Flakes?
It was the inspiration. So when Ella first made the flakes, she wanted to use grains from Midwestern crops because she regarded them as highly nutritious. And she figured out this way to bake them and toast them to create crispy flakes. And they called the stuff granose. But over time, the Kellogg's kept adapting the recipe and the process, and in the late 1890s, they decided to use the same process of crisping and flaking wheat with corn. And so that's where they came up with cornflakes.
That is incredible. Nobody does this alone. I think that's also what, you know, I'm learning more and more doing this and in general, is that patriarchy tells us that people do it alone. Mm-hmm. That there's like these individual heroes who were so brilliant. They were such geniuses. They were, you know, enterprising, et cetera, et cetera. No one gets anywhere alone. No one does anything alone. And men and women have been partnering on things, including work, including science, including design, all those things since the beginning of time. I hate that phrase, behind every great man is a great woman, because they're not behind, right?
Right.
A lot of the times they're right next to, but they don't get any credit. Thanks, Ella. Thanks for the cornflakes. I do love me some frosted flakes.
They are,
I mean,
good.
It completely undercuts all nutritional value because they're dipped in sugar. But guys, they're dipped in sugar.
Right. I don't think, I don't know how Ella would feel about what we've done with cornflakes today.
Where we took her recipes.
Yeah. Like, thanks. And now, you know, all the refined sugar that you didn't like, we're adding it in by the spoonful.
Right.
Well, apparently a lot of people were experimenting with popcorn in this kind of way. You know, what could we add to popcorn to elevate it?
Yeah.
But yeah, food experimentation seemed to be getting pretty big in the 1890s. And experimenting with popcorn by putting molasses on popcorn was a new thing, as well as putting caramel on popcorn.
Ooh.
So one of the foods that we got because of this type of experimentation was the Cracker Jack. The Cracker Jack was showcased at the 1893 World's Fair.
World's Fair again.
Exactly. The World's Fair that Ella was chairman of a food supplies committee at. And just like any other good all-American food, the Cracker Jack was created by immigrants.
They get the job done.
They do.
They get the job done.
So the creators of the Cracker Jack were Frederick Ruckheim and his brother, Louis, and they were German immigrants. And Frederick was already selling popcorn on the streets of Chicago, and he was making some other candies as well. And people were, you know, putting molasses on popcorn, like I mentioned. But his brother, Louis, figured out a process that could keep the popcorn from sticking together.
Ooh.
Which, this is still a company secret. We don't know how they do this.
Oh,
how they
wow.
are able to coat the popcorn, but make it so that they're not totally clumped up.
Do you think they just paint each individual
yes.
popcorn, set them down separately?
Set them aside.
Let them dry.
I would like that job. Just paint a
resident
kernel
painter?
Yeah.
But then I think your title should be kernel, because then you'd be the kernel of kernel painting.
Ooh.
Kernel glazing.
I like it.
Chief Kernel Glazer.
Chief Kernel Glazer. Kernel.
The Kernel.
They wanted to add stripes to the box also to just prove their patriotism. Because when people found out they were like immigrants that made the Cracker Jack, they just weren't as sure anymore. So they really went all out with the red, white, and blue.
Gotcha.
But yeah, Frederick and Louis made these Cracker Jacks, showcased them at the World's Fair. They became a hit, and they ended up getting free advertising because of that song, Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Oh, that wasn't like their jingle?
No, it was another person that wrote the song.
Oh.
Yeah, it wasn't their jingle at all.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. 'Cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball.
So the composer was a guy named Jack Norworth, who was a vaudeville performer and songwriter. And the story goes that while riding the subway home sometime in early spring of 1908 through New York City, he saw a sign that read, "Baseball today, Polo Grounds," and was inspired to write the lyrics during the rest of his subway ride on the back of an envelope. So he was pretty proud of what he wrote, and he decided to share it with another composer friend, Albert von Tilzer, who created the melody, and together they refined the song. So one of the crazy things is that neither of them had ever attended a baseball game, all right?
Just a couple of white men who assume they're experts.
Yeah.
Let me make myself the voice of baseball fans everywhere.
That's Jack and Albert for you. But do you want to know something else that is super surprising about this song?
Yes.
Did you know that it's a feminist anthem?
No.
Uh-huh.
What?
Okay. So this is
crazy. I'm thinking. I'm running through the lyrics.
Okay. Well, you know, most of us know the chorus.
Yes.
But there are actually a couple of verses in there that are probably unknown to most people.
Hmm.
And here's the crazy thing. In the song, those verses are all about a woman named Katie Casey, who was, quote, baseball mad, saw all the games, and knew their players by their first names. She was a baseball super fan.
Oh.
And the song is actually Katie's response to her beau when he asks her if she wants to go out to see a show. But instead she says, take me out to the ball game.
Oh.
Yeah.
What?
I know.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack.
Mm-hmm.
She's not afraid to ask for what she wants.
She's not afraid. So a historian dug into the origin of the song, and it seems that Jack's girlfriend at the time, Trixie Forganza, who was also an actress,
yes,
was a baseball fan, a fan of the Giants, and also an activist and advocate for women's suffrage. And there's actually photos of a suffrage rally that she was a part of, and she's there front and center. And Trixie's photo is on the cover of the sheet music for Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
That is amazing. I love that story.
It blew my mind. So the whole song is this one's response for like, I want to go see the ball game. I know all the players. There's a line in there about arguing with the umpire's call and just being a part of like being in the stadium.
Yeah.
And she's all about getting the peanuts and Cracker Jacks.
So what you're saying is, as feminists, we should all be eating Cracker Jacks.
Obviously.
Obviously, uh-huh. As feminists and patriots, because, mm-hmm. you know, there's stars and stripes.
There's stars and stripes on the Cracker Jack box.
I love that turn of events. Good sleuthing.
Thank you. Thank you. And then from there, the popularity of popcorn in different forms just took off. You started to see it, at, you know, at other concessions and other events. And that's what you're going to dive into in your deep dish.
Yeah. We're going to talk about how popcorn has been linked to entertainment. And we're going to talk specifically in the deep dish about movies.
Ooh, my favorite.
No. If you didn't eat popcorn while watching the movie, did you even see the movie?
No.
No.
Doesn't count.
Doesn't count. You heard it here, folks. Coming up in our deep dish, we're going to talk about how talking pictures, wartime rationing, and an enterprising Missouri woman with a popcorn cart made it so watching movies is never complete without popcorn. All right, Leah, when you think of popcorn, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Movies.
Movies. Oh, man. I miss the movies so much.
Me too.
I miss popcorn. If you go to the movies and there isn't popcorn, it is an incomplete experience.
Oh, yeah. There was one time we were a little uncomfortable with eating our popcorn at the movies.
Mm.
It was because we were watching A Quiet Place and we couldn't like crunch on it. It was so loud. It was embarrassing. We're like, oh, man, now we have to just wait till the end of the movie before we can eat our popcorn.
Oh, but that's so respectful of you to not crunch through the whole thing. But I did read something that, well, it's not exactly an action movie, but there's some action sequences. But they tested people eating popcorn through all sorts of genres of movies. And during action movies, people consumed more popcorn and more snacks than in any other genre. And they think it has to do with like the quick cuts.
Oh.
The quick cuts, the quick movements, kind of like the beats per minute.
Mm-hmm.
Of the movie makes you want to like
eat more and more.
Like you eat with the pace of the movie.
That's totally true. With A Quiet Place, we ate anytime we heard the monster. That was the only chance we could have to like crunch on the popcorn.
Somebody's being ripped to shreds and you're like, quick. Amazing. So if you want to watch your popcorn intake, then you just need to see a lot of like slow indie, mm-hmm. you know, British films with a lot of like long, quiet glances.
Yes.
But I love the experience of even getting the popcorn. That's part of what I think sets this snack apart, is that it is like a whole sensory experience. You're waiting in line. You hear it popping. You see it, like all of the popped kernels coming out of the whatever you call it, the metal dish thing where the kernels pop and they flow down into the pool of kernels. You can smell it. You can see it. It builds anticipation as you're in the line. There's a real theatricality to popcorn.
Oh, yeah. Did I tell you about my favorite concession stand person?
Yes. I love this.
Oh, my God. Shout out to this woman who worked at the Arclight, the dome.
The Cinerama.
The Cinerama dome. She just layered the butter in between like every scoop of popcorn. So you had butteriness all the way through. I always got in her line when I saw her. I was like, she's so good.
But I do that too. I'll take the salt packets and put them in my pocket. And then when I get like a quarter down, I'll resalt it. Because if you only salt it in the lobby, you just get the top like 2 inches with salt, guys. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I have a strategy.
Do you do the unlimited popcorn, like the endless popcorn bucket?
Oh, yeah. The medium is never enough. And I understand that the medium is like 900 servings.
Right. It's bad, though, because I'll get the, you know, bottomless popcorn bucket. And then I'll try to eat as much of it as I can during the previews so that I can go grab more popcorn and fill it back up to the top before the actual movie starts.
Everybody's got a strategy. Mm-hmm. Well, but I will buy the memberships to all of the theaters, and then you get the bump up.
That's true.
So you'd be like, hello, I'm an AMC Premier Stubbs
I'm a Stubbs number.
I'd like a medium, but actually a large popcorn.
Did I mention?
I get the free upgrade.
I'm a Stubbs member.
Did I mention?
I'm on the A-list.
I loved it with the A-list. I loved it when they started putting out like your own aisle with like the velvet ropes for the A-list Stubbs members. They know how to get us.
They do. I mean, that was our dinner at least once a week was just popcorn, because we would go on those special Ticket Tuesday nights. And
oh, yeah. The $5 movies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
It was great.
Popcorn for dinner.
Popcorn for dinner. Recliner seat. A great movie. Loved it.
They get so comfortable now. I actually slept through all of Rogue One. Because it was Christmas time. I was in Buffalo with my family, and my dad wanted to take all of his kids on a fun dad night. So we went to a Mexican restaurant, and then he took us to see Rogue One. But we'd gone to this Mexican restaurant, so I'd eaten like 28 enchiladas and a margarita the size of my head. And then we get into the theater, and it had these reclining leather seats, and also because we were in Buffalo, New York, they were heated.
Wow.
There was a little button on the side, like a car seat warmer.
OMG.
I conked out by the third preview. I woke up and I was like, oh, is that the Death Star? Credits roll. That was it. You know, Leah, we've talked a lot about food trends.
Mm-hmm.
Foods, they get popular, but they come and go.
Yeah.
But like we said in the first episode, foods are a part of our rituals.
Yes.
They're parts of our culture. So we haven't talked yet about the foods that don't come and go.
Mm-hmm.
The foods that kind of stick around and get embedded in our experiences. So what about those? And this is a fantastic one.
Yeah.
So today in the Deep Dish, we are going to dive into the love story between popcorn and movies that is a century in the making.
Oh.
So in 1893, a man named Charles Kreeters invented a portable popcorn machine, which really set our story in motion. So Charles Kreeters attached a steam engine to a peanut cart with a mechanism that would pop the corn in oil.
Hmm.
But the steam engine was a little bit much, so he refined it. And by 1900, he'd improved it with an electric engine and a contraption that would butter and salt the popcorn.
Genius.
There was a huge draw of these small portable popcorn carts. And I was looking at pictures of these, and what's really interesting is we still make popcorn machines that look exactly like the one that he made.
Mm-hmm.
So like the ornate red borders and the like circusy lettering, and you can see the gears, like the wheel on the inside.
Right.
That looks like what this guy made, even though now ours are like USB powered.
Mm-hmm.
The most important aspect of this was that it was portable, because for decades, vendors had operated out of wagons parked near theaters, circuses, ballparks, selling a variety of snacks. They were basically like the original food trucks.
Yeah.
But the portable carts meant they could be more mobile, more independent, and easily go from place to place following the events that had the most people. So popcorn was especially a popular snack to sell for these vendors because it was very, very cheap. And the smell was its own advertisement, right? The smell of popcorn is unique. It's very powerful. It's very attractive, and it spreads. So a few years after Kreeters invents this portable popcorn machine, in 1905, the first movie theater opened in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it was basically just a bunch of folding chairs set up around a projector in a storefront. And the owner named it the Nickelodeon because a nickel is how much a ticket cost. And Odeon is ancient Greek for theater. And movies had been shown between acts in vaudeville shows or in theaters on nights that there weren't shows. There was nothing dedicated to movies. They were kind of filler until these storefront Nickelodeons starting popping up all over the place. But then in 1913, the first real movie theater opened in New York City.
Yeah.
So this theater gave it a seriousness, a respectability, and kind of established movies as a medium on their own. Theaters started to be building all over the country. And then in 1918, Grauman's Chinese Theater opened up in Hollywood, which is probably the most iconic movie theater in the world.
Yep.
And these early theaters were gorgeous. They were ornate. They were richly decorated because they wanted to harness the appeal of glamorous Hollywood and give the moviegoers a little taste of that glamour, make them feel like they were movie stars going into these premieres. So listeners, I don't know if you've ever been in these old theaters, but they are just the all Art Deco 1920s, 1930s theaters, but they are just astounding. Movie going at this point was getting very popular, but it was mostly a middle and upper class thing. And I'll explain why in a minute. So two major things happened in the late 1920s that led to the simultaneous boom of popcorn and movie theaters. By the late 1920s, we had all these beautiful venues. Hollywood was up and running out in California. Movie going culture was a thing. There were all these production companies pumping out movies. So movie technology started getting some real investment and attention, which led to sound. Music, effects, and most importantly, dialogue. In 1927, The Jazz Singer was the first movie with sound. It premiered in New York City at the Warner Brothers Theater. And you could see the whole story of this era in this wonderful documentary called Singing in the Rain. It's not a documentary, but it is my favorite. It is my favorite movie.
Everybody go home until further notice. What is this?
Yeah, what's the matter, R.F.?
The Jazz Singer. That's what's the matter. The Jazz Singer.
Oh, my darling little mammy down in Alabama. My little baby.
Oh, no, this is no joke, Cosmo. It's a sensation. The public is screaming for more.
More what?
Talking pictures. Talking pictures.
Oh, it's just a freak.
Yeah, what a freak. We should have such a freak at this studio. I told you talking pictures were a menace, but no one would listen to me. Don, we're going to put our best feet forward. We're going to make the Dueling Cavalier into a talking picture.
Talking picture? Well, that means I'm out of a job. At last, I can start suffering and write that symphony.
You're not out of a job. We're putting you in as head of the new music department.
Well, thanks, R.F. At last, I can stop suffering and write that symphony. Now, wait a second, Mr. Simpson. Talking pictures. I think you should
wait. Every studio is jumping on the bandwagon, Dexter. All the theaters are putting in sound equipment. We don't want to be left out of it.
We don't know anything about this gadget.
What do you have to know? It's a picture. You do what you always did. You just add talking to it.
Yeah?
Don, believe me, it will be a sensation. Lamont and Lockwood, they talk.
Well, of course we talk. Don't everybody?
So remember how I said that moviegoing was mostly a middle or upper class thing? Okay. So in a silent movie, when there's no dialogue, how does the movie tell you what's going on?
Right. You have to read it.
You have to be able to read it. The title cards, the subtitles. So the only people that could really enjoy studio Hollywood films up until that point were people who could read.
Right.
But because you could hear the dialogue, now illiterate Americans could finally enjoy the movies too.
That's so true.
So sound in movies wasn't just a milestone for technology. It wasn't just a milestone for the arts. It was a milestone for accessibility.
Yeah. Now it's just opened it up to so many more people to be able to take part and watch movies. Yeah.
So that's the first thing that happened in the late 20s. The next thing, of course, was the stock market crash of 1929 brought on the Great Depression. Popcorn, as we said, it was a very, very cheap food and, like Ella Kellogg discovered, was very filling and had a lot of nutritional value. And during all trying times, we need some entertainment. We need some comfort. We need some joy. And so movies were cheap escapism, right? So the result was, while sales of all other snack foods and treats declined, popcorn sales actually rose.
Wow.
During the Depression. Yeah. And so did movie going. Get this. In 1930, weekly movie attendance soared to 90 million people in the U.S. when the total population was only 123 million people.
What? That's insane.
Yeah. So 90 out of 123, like 75% of people were going to the movies every single week.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that insane?
Uh-huh.
So what were ubiquitous around any kind of event and entertainment? The food vendors, right? The food vendors started showing up outside of movie theaters. And selling popcorn became like a Depression-era cottage industry because there was a huge profit. An article I read from the Smithsonian said that one $10 bag of popcorn kernels in the 1930s would last for years.
Jeez.
Right? So a lot of popcorn vendors were standing outside theaters. Theaters wanted nothing to do with these vendors. They did not want your nasty snacks in their gorgeous, classy, ornate movie theaters. It would ruin the experience. It would be distracting from the films, they thought. And people would trash the place. It would ruin the lovely rugs and the sticky soda spills and their greasy popcorn fingerprints. And you know what? They're 100% right. They're 100% right.
Yeah, that's true.
We are filthy. There is no refined way to eat popcorn. As I said, I eat it like a frog. That's the cleanest way that I can eat it. There's no way to not get crumbs everywhere. They're totally right. So theaters would put up signs at coat checks that said, check your coats and your popcorn. Vendors would sneak in and walk up and down the aisles to sell popcorn and other snacks. They get chased out.
So sneaky.
But then an enterprising woman named Julia Braden came up with a scheme to put her popcorn business ahead of the rest and ended up creating the business model that movie theaters still use to this day.
What?
So Julia Braden was an entrepreneur in Kansas City, Missouri, who had a popcorn cart, and she would set up shop outside of movie theaters. But standing outside movie theaters was annoying.
No doubt.
She had to deal with the weather. She had to deal with other vendors and compete with them to get the best space or to get the best customers. The theaters would chase them away. Then a theater declared that it was going to charge vendors $1 a day to stand outside their theater. And this gave Julia a kernel of an idea. Love my puns.
The puns are the best.
It's the season finale. We weren't going to get out of here without some puns, guys. You knew this. She approached the Linwood Theater of Kansas City and said, listen, instead of charging me $1 to stand outside, why don't you let me come inside, set up shop in your lobby, and I will give you a cut of my popcorn sales, because I know you're not making barely anything off those stupid tickets, but people love my noms. We could be making bank. And after some, you know, buttering up, after some persuading, the Linwood agreed, which started Julia Braden's popcorn empire. By 1931, she owned popcorn stands in movie theaters all over town and was pulling in more than $14,400 a year, which is the equivalent of $336,000 today.
Amazing.
Right?
What a genius.
Her business grew even in the midst of the Depression, because theater owners that had her popcorn stands could lower the price of tickets to draw people to their theater, knowing that they'd make up that money with the concession sales, right? Which may have helped the movie houses in Kansas City to stay afloat, even when the big, expensive, ornate, hard-to-run theaters around the country were going bust. So whether she knew it or not, Julia Braden pioneered a new movie business strategy that the money was in the concessions, not the tickets.
Wow. I did not know this was from Julia Braden. This is how it still runs today.
It still runs today, right? Way. So, Leah, you and I know from working at a movie company that the exhibitors, meaning the theater companies, don't make a ton of money off the ticket sales because part of the agreement with the distribution companies that actually distribute the films is that they get a share of any revenue that comes in from the ticket sales. So only about half of their money comes from these ticket sales. Mm-hmm. But they get all the money they want from the concessions.
Yeah.
So theaters sell popcorn at a markup between 800 and 1,500%. They make an estimated 85% profit off concession sales, which constitute 46% on average of a movie theater's overall profits. So, yeah, that popcorn that you just paid $8 for is absolutely not worth $8. You're right. We all know it.
Yeah. And we do it.
We do it anyway. It's part of the agreement. And this has been the butt of many jokes and many complaints and at least one lawsuit.
Ah.
In 2012, after the local AMC theater in Livonia, Michigan, banned outside food, a man named Joshua Thompson sued them for overcharging on snacks and demanded that either AMC allowed outside food in or they lower the price of snacks. It got thrown out, obviously, but it is the most American thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. You know he's still bringing snacks in from the outside. You know that dude.
Hey, man, you can sneak in snacks in your pants like the rest of us.
Right. When you hear that crack of a can.
Theater. What do you think umbrellas are for if not hiding tall boys?
Of course I have to bring this huge purse in with me.
That's why you get the purses with so many compartments. They're not going to make you unzip the side pocket. This new business model caught on. Theaters started regularly renting space to vendors inside their lobbies. But then in the mid-1930s, exhibitors like a man named R.J. McKenna, who ran a chain of theaters in California, took it a step further. R.J. McKenna had these theaters which had vendors hanging out outside, and he found out that an old man who'd been peddling popcorn outside of one of his movie houses had amassed enough money from the popcorn to buy a car, a house, a farm, and a store.
This is the inspiration for the Yum Day Snack Shop. Guys, I'm just going to peddle popcorn.
Keep selling that popcorn, Leah.
Yeah.
Someday we'll have real studios.
It's simple. That's all I want to do.
Anyway, so McKenna found this out and he was like, screw the rugs.
Yeah.
He installed commercial popcorn machines in his lobbies. He built vents in the walls to let the smoke from the oil escape. And he made as much as $200,000 a year just from these popcorn stands alone.
What?
Yes. I even read several stories about theater chains and how they would put popcorn machines in some theaters and not others, and the ones without the popcorn machines all closed.
Whoa.
Showing the same movies.
Huh.
But the theaters with the popcorn machines stayed open. Isn't that crazy?
That's pretty crazy.
I hate giving quotes without the source. I couldn't find the source for this, but it kept coming up in different articles I was reading. A movie entrepreneur at the time said, find a good popcorn location and build a theater around it.
Wise words.
So this brings us up to the late 1930s. And over the course of that decade, of course, Hollywood kept growing, the movie industry kept growing, and technology grew, including the use of color in films. So filmmakers had been playing around with color since the 1910s, but it was perfected and exploded onto the scene with the iconic, classic, beloved 1938 film. What am I going to say, Leah?
The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz.
So good. I love it.
The first full color studio film. I was getting choked up last night thinking about this because, like, imagine it's 1938. You're in the audience.
Yeah.
You're watching this movie. The movie's going along. It's already crazy. It's already bonkers. You're like, what the fuck? She's flying on a bike. She's stuck in a tornado. What is happening now? This is crazy. And then Dorothy walks from black and white into color.
It is amazing.
Can you imagine being in that audience? You're with Dorothy. You're seeing this for the first time, too. And the ruby slippers, all of it. Just amazing. Anyway, getting verklempt. Then, of course, at the end of 1941, we enter World War II. Because of things like our supply chains being cut off, the Germans and Japanese were tanking our cargo ships, and the fact that we were providing food for our allies in Europe who were basically starving after fighting the war for so many years, in the spring of 1942, the U.S. started a rationing program, and sugar was the first thing to be rationed.
Ah.
So families were limited to only 2 pounds of sugar a month.
Wow.
And bakeries and candy manufacturers had to work with only 2/3 of the normal amount of sugar. So obviously, candy, sweet treats,
right.
baked goods started disappearing. But you know what wasn't rationed? Salt.
You could get salty stuff.
And certainly, corn wasn't being rationed. We have entire states made of corn.
Right.
I'm talking about you, Nebraska. I'm looking at you. So popcorn was one of the only, quote, non-essential foods, so snack foods, that actually saw sales increase during the war because they were taking the place of all these other snacks that couldn't be made because of the rationing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, movie going increased, both because of the escapism that we've talked about, but also because that's where you got news about the war.
Yes, that's right.
In the newsreels. So all of this cements popcorn as inextricably linked to movies.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
And since then, our entertainment habits have changed. Our movie-going habits have changed. But what's really interesting is it seems like whatever happens, popcorn goes where the movies go.
Yeah, exactly.
So, for example, in the 1950s, 1960s, people started getting televisions in their homes, which meant they didn't need to go out to a theater to get some screened entertainment. They had it at home. So it was the first time movie-going declined. So the popcorn industry adjusted and made popcorn for home viewing. Jiffy Pop was introduced in 1960. Stovetop poppers, air poppers, with watching television while eating the popcorn prominently featured in all their advertising. Right? They knew what it was for.
Yep.
Then in the late 1970s, microwave ovens started becoming commercially available to people. So popcorn adjusted again. And in 1981, the first microwavable popcorn hit the shelves. All the time, still advertising, still trying to mimic the movie-going experience.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all like movie theater butter.
Yep, it is. The packaging has like little, you know, curtains on it, like the act
Yeah,
two.
Or like the film strip lines on the side. Yeah.
Now appearing at a living room near you. Orville Redenbacher's ultimate theater-style popcorn. Our pour-over pouch lets you add all the buttery topping you want, so nothing tastes fresher or more buttery. Ultimate theater-style popcorn from Orville Redenbacher. Just like at the movies, only better.
And then in 1980s and 90s, when video rental was huge, just pour one out for Blockbuster.
Yes.
You know, popcorn was always a part of it. Remember where you'd get two videos and you got free popcorn?
Oh, yeah, totally. I would be like, well, I guess I got to get my second video so I can get the popcorn with it.
It was great. That's how I saw any movie that wasn't a new release, is they were like, if you get a new release and you get an old-timey movie nobody wants, you get a free popcorn.
Yeah, that's right. I would get like the old-timey movie.
Something in black and white, a lot of horses.
Mm-hmm.
So that specialness of the taste, the smell, the experience of eating popcorn, the nostalgia we have of having popcorn at the movies is all part of our expectation of it. It's all part of the draw. So this is just a perfect example of how a food became part of a ritual and a cultural ritual, not something religious.
Yeah.
You know, not something ancient, but just something that grew out of the time, the place, the events, the politics, the agriculture, and the emotional needs of our culture, of our world. And it stuck.
It did. That was awesome. That was so great. I love, like, actually walking through how this became part of our day-to-day and how I, you know, always expect to have popcorn or make popcorn right before I sit down and watch a show or a movie at home. And if I don't have the popcorn, it's just, did it even happen?
Didn't even happen. You didn't even see that movie. Nope. Can't talk about it.
And I love the story about Julia Braden.
I know.
Come on. I mean, that's...
Why don't we know her name? Why isn't she taught in business schools? Maybe she is. I didn't go to business school. But man, we've uncovered so many incredible women.
Yeah.
In food history over the last 8 episodes.
We have. Names that I've never heard of before until now.
Right?
Business owners, writers, activists.
Yeah, all kinds of activists, publishers, creators, inventors, mm-hmm. businesswomen. It's just so awesome. That was something that we wanted when we started out, was to highlight these, you know, quote, hidden figures of the food world. And everyone that we come up with is just so exciting.
Yeah. It really is. We get so just...
We get really excited. Yeah,
really thrilled when we're like, oh, did you hear about this? It makes us mad, too, for a little, because we're like, why?
Why have we never heard this name? But now we know her name. Julia Braden.
Julia Braden.
So we're talking about entertainment and food. And just that's what we're all about here at Every Day is a Food Day. That's what we want to give you. You know, movies took off because people wanted some escapism and to feel something. And so our kind of core directive in everything that we've done, whether it's heavy research on these topics and these women or our Instagram posts, honestly, it all comes back to this principle of we want to give you something that is joyful and fascinating.
Yes.
We want to give you a few minutes where you can come into the room with us, be part of our conversation, and escape from the bleak, bleak shit that is going on and has been going on for a while now. So we hope that we've been successful in that. I know that for me, it's just been such a joy.
Oh, yeah. No, it's so wonderful to be able to hang out with your friend, tell some really amazing stories about incredible people that many of us have never heard of before. And, you know, to share that kind of hidden history, really cool facts. And then just have like fun and laugh.
And celebrate food. We hope when you have peanut butter or bacon or donuts, you'll think of us.
Yeah. When you have that fruitcake, think of us.
Thank you for going on this journey with us. We love you.
We love you guys.
Food stories are people stories. And every one of you has a story too. If there is a spring.
If there is one.
We'll see you then. Thank you all enough for joining us for this first season of Every Day is a Food Day. We'll be back later in the year with more episodes, but in the meantime, we'll have some treats for you, so please connect with us on Instagram at Food Day Pod or sign up for our newsletter at yumday.co/podcast.
The clips you heard today were from Singing in the Rain and Take Me Out to the Ball Game, both from MGM Studios. And Let's All Go to the Lobby, courtesy of the Library of Congress.
Every Day is a Food Day is a production of Van Balen Productions and Yum Day. It was created, written, and hosted by Leah Ballantyne and Anna Van Balen. Our production intern is Emma Massey, and our marketing intern is Elaine O.
See you soon.
Bye. Happy 2021. Hang in there.
We love you.
Eat snacks.
Snacks.
Snack it up.